This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Brent Nachtigall, Middle East correspondent of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine, and I'll be filling in for Joel Hilliker this week on Trumpet Hour. Countless United States presidents over the past decades have tried to complete diplomacy's hardest task, that of bringing a comprehensive peace deal between Israelis and Palestinians. Well, just as the Trump administration begins its attempt, the Palestinians might be looking past the U.S. already towards Europe as a future broker of peace. We're going to talk to Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this surprising move. Second, the media screamed racism when, as soon as coming into office, Donald Trump decided to issue a three-month order stopping immigration from seven Muslim countries until the government had reviewed its vetting procedure. Turns out this week that the lower courts were wrong to intrude into the president's decision-making, with the Supreme Court ruling to allow Mr. Trump to go ahead with the order. We'll talk to Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the decision and whether this is a sign of things to come with the addition of Trump's selection, Mr. Neil Gorsuch, to the court. Then we'll talk about some blunt and forthright comments American and military officials have been making about the war in Afghanistan. Yes, America's longest war continues to this day, and with it seems no end in sight. We'll talk about the Afghan war with Trumpet writer Kieran Underwood and why we are at decision time for the U.S. military in Afghanistan. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Last week, Jared Kushner and Jason Greenblatt were in Israel on behalf of the United States President Donald Trump to try and resurrect the moribund peace process between Israelis and Palestinians. This is something that Mr. Trump has called the ultimate deal, and he's dispatching his own son-in-law, a practicing Jew, to try and get it done. While Israelis are treating Trump's overtures toward peace cautiously, a story appeared this week that indicates the Palestinians are already looking past Mr. Trump to another potential broker of Middle Eastern peace. To tell us about all of this, we have Trumpet.com assisting managing editor Richard Palmer on the line from our office in the United Kingdom. Greetings, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So Mr. Trump hasn't even got started, and the Palestinians, it seems, may be moving on.
That's right. Yes, I thought it was a really remarkable article published on June 18th in our Monitor that was talking about this. I guess Jared Kushner, he's over there already right now, as I understand it. But this did come out before he had left, before it had even gotten going. And it was talking about how if things didn't go well, they were ready to go to Germany. The article was based on some comments by an unnamed senior Palestinian minister close to President Mahmoud Abbas, is how they put it. And they said that that they were going to opt for German Chancellor Angela Merkel in conjunction with the new French President Emmanuel Macron if they didn't like how these new negotiations with the U.S. went.
So you talked about Mr. Kushner being there right now. Is there any indication that things have already hit a snag, or does it look like they're going to give him some time to work something out?
Yeah, that's always, I guess, you know, part of it, you've got to distinguish between what's reality and what's negotiating tactics. I did see some stories over the weekend that, yeah, it did sound like the Palestinians were kind of ready to walk out and give up already. Now, how much of that is just, you know, we need to be tough in our negotiation tactics and we want to look like we're going to be hard to get on side, and how much of that is just reality, I don't know. But nobody's made any money betting on the success of Middle Eastern peace negotiations recently.
Right, not so, for some time. Yeah, it does look like that's the case with Mr. Kushner trying to get some concessions out of the Palestinians. I saw reports this week that one of the stipulations, if there is going to be a peace deal that goes forward, is that the Palestinian Authority has to stop paying the families of terrorists that are currently in Israeli prisons. And it seems like that would be something that would be easy to accept. They were rebuffed on that, the United States. So maybe they're... Maybe the demise of this effort of Mr. Trump might come sooner than expected. So you were just saying here when we were just introducing this piece that you felt like this might have been bluster or potentially leaking this story to try and get the United States to see that we're not all in with you. We have other options if you don't lean to our side. Is that what you mean?
Well, I kind of meant more those statements on Friday when the negotiation, as soon as the negotiations get started, then Mahmoud Abbas and some of those higher leaders start saying this isn't working. You know, that's kind of exactly what you would say if you wanted to play hardball. It was more those statements I think I was referring to. I think on these, it does look like there is some substance behind them. I think it makes a lot of sense even from the Palestinian point of view. You know, everybody's talking about now Germany being the new leader of the free world. Europe as a whole is making itself more and more of a credible alternative to the United States. And again, the fact that it would be Germany in conjunction with Emmanuel Macron kind of shows they're looking at perhaps more of a wider European dimension than just specifically Germany. And you also look at the way Germany's behaved, and especially the German foreign minister, Sigmar Gabriel. They've certainly proven themselves much, much more pro-Palestinian and even anti-Donald Trump, anti-Israeli than Donald Trump has, who has taken a stance that probably the Palestinians are not as keen on. You know, just for example, over the weekend, a spokesman for Sigmar Gabriel kind of put Israel in the same category as Russia and China as a kind of a non-functioning democracy. And it was a pretty outrageous statement, and there were quite a few within Germany that were quick to criticize it. But you look at other things, especially on Sigmar Gabriel's track record here,
right,
where he chose to meet with some basically anti-Israeli NGOs rather than meeting with the Israeli prime minister. He called Israel an apartheid state at one point, which,
right,
again, is absolutely outrageous. So you can certainly see if you're of the Palestinians, you would much rather work with Europe and with Germany than Donald Trump. And this perhaps gives them, you know, the presidency of Donald Trump and just this global ascendancy of Germany when it comes to how people view Germany and descent of the United States gives them a good opportunity, I think, to perhaps jump tracks here.
Right.
And at the same time, much as Sigmar Gabriel has kind of taken this anti-Israel stand, there still is a lot that Israeli politicians
That was my next question. I mean, the Palestinians might be gung-ho with the Europeans taking over the brokership here of Middle Eastern peace, but in your opinion, do you feel like Israel, the other party here, would accept their entrance and replacement of the United States?
It is a good question, and I think the United States under Donald Trump certainly does seem preferable, and it seems like just based on how Benjamin Netanyahu, for example, has greeted Donald Trump and some of the things he said, would prefer Donald Trump as a mediator there. But at the same time, I don't think they would throw out of hand the idea of Germany. You know, these two nations, Israel and Germany, are very close still. They have their, I think it's every 18 months, they have a joint cabinet meeting, and it's kind of, that's a very rare symbol of unity that the two have there. Germany gives Israel some pretty crucial arms exports and preferential deals on things even as strategic as the submarines that at least everyone kind of unofficially knows are probably the submarines that launch Israel's nuclear missiles. So and Angela Merkel, I think, has proven herself to be a friend of Israel, but certainly more pro-Israel than a lot of other German politicians. So you can see why they would accept Germany. And perhaps as you see America retreat on the world stage, as you see perhaps Donald Trump kind of almost becoming toxic to other nations, the last thing Israel needs is more things to kind of make them toxic to other nations or to give them a bad rap. So you could see circumstances where they would accept a greater European role, and especially if Donald Trump starts putting some of his America First rhetoric into practice, his, you know, less foreign engagements, stepping back from the world, and all of this kind of thing that would presumably, if we followed it to its logical conclusion, mean less support for Israel.
Right, right. So, Israel, I think you're right. I think they would be willing, especially especially the way they see world public opinion favoring Germany and their role in the world. Lots, you've even brought attention to a lot of those news headlines that talk about its moral ascendancy. To speak on behalf of the morals of, is like the most moral power on the planet. And when you're dealing with the Palestinian-Israeli crisis, this is like the issue that most people would think about needing to be resolved quickly by such a moral power. Do you think Germany would be willing to jump at such a brokership? I know they've done certain things with Russia over Ukraine. They've been involved in the Minsk agreements there, but they haven't had a huge history, at least recently, of being so involved in the foreign policy of other nations. So would they jump at it?
Well, I think this is one of the most interesting points about this Al Monitor piece is, again, it's citing unnamed senior ministers, but it does sound like that Germany is gearing up to play a much greater role and that they're even kind of working on a peace plan based on what it was saying. So this article says that the minister said that Ramallah is in close contact with the German foreign minister, Sigmar Gabriel, regarding Berlin taking more of a lead role in a two-state solution. So if that's true, they're already kind of laying the groundwork for getting more involved. This article says that a senior official in the German Foreign Office told Al Monitor that Merkel is now ready to play a more active and independent role in Middle East policy. And they basically said that the plan that they're working on at the moment is kind of this an EU Marshall Plan for Israel and the Palestinian Authority, where they would put forward conditions for both sides. And they would say, well, if you meet these conditions, well, that unlocks a flood of investment from Europe and a flood of European money,
right?
Which is an interesting. If they're working on an approach like that, I think that shows that Germany is interested, and it's a different approach from the one that the United States
it doesn't
has
look like
so far.
It has been tried to that degree before. So we've been talking here for 10 or 12 minutes about Germany getting involved in this random Al Monitor piece that hasn't, no one else has really been reporting this, but this is obviously something that we have been watching for and that we fully expect to happen. I wonder if you could just talk about why at the Trumpet we keep a keen eye on both Israeli relationship with the Palestinians, but especially Germany trying to get a foothold in there.
Yeah, there are really two key prophecies that we're watching that just kind of leapt off the pages of this Al Monitor piece. And yeah, the big one is about this peace process and talking about Germany getting more involved in that peace process, because this has been something that we've been talking and writing about at the Plain Truths, or in the Philadelphia Trumpet, since the early 90s. It's been in the Plain Truth long before then, about how Germany is going to be more involved here. The Bible talks about Israel in the Middle East turning to Germany to help solve its peace the problems related to the peace process. It talks about Israel trusting Germany, just inviting Germany in to take care of those problems. And so we've had articles. I think one of the big ones was called "The Counterfeit Peacemaker." We've got one that you can find fairly easily on our front page by Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, called "The Outcome of the Israeli-German Relationship," that just goes through a whole load of those prophecies pretty comprehensively and showing what these are all talking about here. But there are a whole load of different scriptures that talk about Israel turning to Assyria, which we've got material on our website to prove that that's modern-day Germany, asking for help in solving this peace process. And then also the other point that just really jumped out of this Al Monitor is just the wider point about German involvement in the Middle East. And that's something else that is closely tied to the peace process, but something else that we've been expecting. This said that the source in the German Foreign Office said that Germany's goals in the region are to be part of a Western Arab coalition against terrorism. And, well, that's almost exactly what the Bible says. It talks about a German alliance with other powers in the Middle East. A Western Arab coalition is exactly what is described in Psalm 83.
Right.
And we've got plenty of material to talk about that. But of course, the Psalm 83 alliance, if you look at what the objective of that alliance there is, it's not to combat terrorism, though it may well in practice, that may well initially be part of that alliance, but it's against Israel.
Right.
And so, you know, just as all of these prophecies that talk about Germany or Israel trusting Germany, and then they talk about Germany double-crossing Israel. And so then you see that complete tie in there with the Psalm 83 alliance that ultimately says this alliance turns on Israel. So we watch this very closely at the trumpet because this alliance is prophesied to happen, but then it's also prophesied to turn out very, very badly for Israel. And that's an important warning that we have to get out.
Yeah, and I think as you said, we've got a lot of material. If that sounded a little bit difficult to understand, there's just a lot of prophecies here that are moving in this situation where Israel does go to Germany and then eventually does get turned on with this German-Arab relationship. We've been talking to trumpet writer Richard Palmer. There is an article entitled Germany, the New Middle Eastern Peacemaker, up right now on thetrumpet.com. You can read that and it'll fill you in on some of the details. Thanks very much, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's been almost 6 months since United States President Donald Trump issued a travel ban to most foreign travelers to America from 7 at-risk Middle East nations. However, shortly thereafter, the order was blocked from taking effect because of numerous lower court decisions. Now, as the case makes it to the United States' highest court, the Supreme Court, the judges have ruled largely in favor of the president's constitutional right to stem immigration to the country if it's in the United States' national security interest. To talk about this and its potential ramifications, we have in studio here in Edmond, Oklahoma, our man that watches all things America, Mr. Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
So, Andrew, it seems that Mr. Trump was within his constitutional bounds to put the 3-month hold on travel from these Middle Eastern countries after all.
It does definitely look like that. And we've covered actually that on both previous lower court strike downs of the president's executive order. We had a segment on this program. And so I guess just kind of recapping when the president initially put a travel ban on 7 countries known for exporting jihadists, a court in Minnesota ruled that it wasn't constitutional because the president failed to provide proof that there actually was a terrorist threat from nations like Iran and Syria. And as ridiculous as that case may be, we pointed out it kind of overlooked the larger issue that it's not actually a judge's constitutional responsibility to determine if a threat is real or not. It's just the responsibility to determine, does the president have the right to ban travel from certain countries if there is a threat?
So that was basically, I guess, those decisions kind of halted in its tracks after a few days that Mr. Trump tried to stop people from coming in. Then for the past 6 months, it's kind of been just people coming in as normal as they did in the Obama administration.
Right. The flows, I think, it's been a while since I looked at the exact number, but I know it's several thousand who've come in from these countries over the course of the past 6 months while this has been bogged down in the courts. And so that's what happened yesterday is the Supreme Court, they actually haven't heard the whole case yet. They've agreed to hear the case in October. But in the meantime, they said the travel ban can go into effect with the one exception that they said if anyone has living in these 6 nations, it is now, if they have like a wife or a relative or a job offer in the United States, they can come for that. They just can't come as a tourist or for some other reason.
Right. So largely it kind of followed what Mr. Trump wanted initially. The Supreme Court obviously has a different makeup now than it did under Mr. Obama with the death of Antonin Scalia. Did that contribute to the new judge coming into the Supreme Court, did that contribute to this decision, or was it bipartisan?
Actually, this particular decision was unanimous for all nine justices, which does, in one hand, just highlight how unconstitutional both these lower court rulings from the Fourth Circuit Court and the Ninth Circuit Court were, that even very progressive justices like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and others were willing to actually at least partially reinstate this travel ban until they can hear the case in October.
Right. That's what's amazing to me, is they actually haven't officially, you know, this hasn't come before the Supreme Court in its complete entirety. They're going to analyze it further. But it's so obvious to all nine Supreme Court justices, whether they're left-leaning or right, that this is in the constitutional power of the president.
Right. So that is definitely a pretty stinging rebuke to those lower courts. And when they do hear it in October, it could still be controversial. So far, the new Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, along with Supreme Court Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, have already come out on record saying that they're going to argue to argue that the full ban, Trump's full ban, was legal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just three. So then it will be kind of, I guess it would be controversial when they hear it in October, is like, whether was the full ban legal, or do they actually have to allow those with family in the United States to be able to come back? And in some ways it might be kind of a moot point by that point, because since it is a 90-day travel ban, if it goes into effect immediately,
it would have already
have expired by the time they're hearing that case.
Right. So I wonder if this was even, of course, I mean, there was a court order for him to stop this process, but it has been 6 months of kind of people coming to the country without this vetting process being analyzed. So do you feel like it is still applicable, this three-month travel ban, since we've had 6 months of unfettered access to the United States?
Right. That is kind of a unique thing, is that if it would have just gone into effect unopposed in early February unopposed, it would have actually already have been expired by now.
Right.
And so now that they're said, if the Trump administration, they haven't put it in full effect yet, but once they do get this in effect, I mean, it will be until October that they'll have to review vetting procedures and all that. So that is, and even Clarence Thomas, when he wrote his piece arguing that they should have just reinstated the full travel ban, he does mention that the next 3 months might be kind of messy, in the fact that now there's going to be all these court cases trying to figure out exactly who has an existing relationship,
right,
with the United States. Like, does it have to be a wife, or can it be a third cousin? Or
right. Well, I just find it this very interesting, and maybe you can kind of just reflect on the initial reaction, not just from these courts that decided to strike this down initially, but also just media reporting, people coming out in mass on social media, even calling Trump a racist because of this. This wasn't a Middle East nation ban. It was a Muslim ban. That's what they were calling it. What is their reaction to this over the last couple of days?
Right. And it will definitely be interesting how it develops, because I know the Democratic National Party Chairman Tom Perez had definitely made a statement already to The Guardian in England that this is bigoted and unconstitutional, and that the Democratic Party is going to continue to fight this all the way into the court case in October, trying to make the case that, I don't know if he made the racist claim, but definitely trying to make the case that, well, this is religious discrimination. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it's not a Muslim ban. It's from six very particular nations that have a history of exporting jihadists. And even the one thing a lot of people don't mention is that they say, it was like, well, this is, especially on like the left side of the media, say, it's like, well, this is a violation of religious freedom. They said, okay, well, the First Amendment does give Americans a right to practice whatever religion they choose, but it has nothing to do with giving everyone in the world
right, that's
unfettered
for Americans
access,
right,
to come here.
Right. Right. I wonder if maybe you could talk about how, because people are going to see this decision and they're going to look at it in the context of Mr. Neil Gorsuch being part of the Supreme Court now, even though, as you said, this was a unanimous decision. I know that there's some pretty hot, big hot button topics that the Supreme Court is meant to see over the next few months, if I'm correct in that. Do you feel like this is the beginning of a change on the Supreme Court, where we see a more them favoring more conservative, or coming out on the side of the conservatives on more of these court cases that are going to come before the Supreme Court this summer?
Well, it could be. Well, Neil Gorsuch basically just restores the status quo as it existed a year and a half ago, before Antonin Scalia died. Although Anthony Kennedy is famous swing vote, who's 81 and has mentioned that he is planning to retire sometime relatively soon, probably before Mr. Trump leaves office.
So he might get another pick.
And so if he gets one more pick, that would definitely be a switch back in a conservative direction, which would be, I guess it could be interesting and concerning to see how that would unfold. As already, I mean, and these aren't like fringe characters, but even like high ranking officials like Tom Perez in the Democratic Party has brought up the allegations of Russian hacking, which have not been proved at all, but used them to say that, like, well, if we're not sure if President Trump is even a legitimate president because of this Russia issue,
right,
therefore whatever Supreme Court justices he's nominated are not legitimate. And they've had a couple other fairly high up officials in the Democratic Party almost just raising that specter that, like, Neil Gorsuch isn't even a real Supreme Court justice, so why do we care what he rules?
Right. Well, I can see this just looking forward another, you know, 6 months or a year, just in case we do have a new Supreme Court judge. I can see the left, especially in the United States, looking at the Supreme Court as a another branch of government that is illegitimate if it becomes a more of a conservative base and start making more conservative rulings on issues that come before them. We know that they're doing that with Mr. Trump, calling him an illegitimate president. And maybe another branch of government is going, this is kind of the last one basically, right? That hasn't seem to be so conservative. We know that the House and the Senate now have the conservative majority there. So do you think that this could belittle rule of law going forward in the United States?
I definitely think that seems to be the bigger trend that it's moving in. And there's several other court cases that Neil Gorsuch may be a deciding vote on, one over whether they haven't heard yet, but they just decided to hear over whether Christian bakers have to make wedding cakes for, right, homosexual weddings or not. And a couple other controversial ones like that, where if you're already slurring the president as illegitimate and then his Supreme Court pick is illegitimate, especially if he gets another pick to and start getting some of these more controversial rulings, just given what we've seen already with and like universities in America, right, with the protest and things like that. I mean, as horrible as it sounds, I mean, that does seem to be the direction society is moving, where it's very much a party spirit is like, well, I'm for what my party's for, or I'm not for my party's for, without actually looking into the legalities of what the law says.
Right. And, you know, surprisingly, well, it was surprising to me just to see how unanimous this past decision, this decision on Monday really was. I wonder if you just, going back to that, if you have some of the write-up, do you have anything that was mentioned by the judges about this case specifically?
Right. I read a bit of the dissent or the piece that Justice Clarence Thomas wrote up arguing for the full ban, where he was just making I don't actually have a quote with me right now, but I just making kind of one of the points that I made earlier about how the Constitution gives Congress the power to determine immigration policy, and in 1952 Congress delegated the authority to the president that if he thinks there's a national security threat, he, right, can suspend immigration from whatever country he wants for 90 days.
Right.
And so it said the and just pointing out just how ridiculous some of these lower court rulings were that are saying it's like, well, the president has to prove that Iran's a terrorist that before he can do this, or in the
which shouldn't be too difficult to do anyway. But that's beside the point, is what you're saying,
right? And that's definitely the way the Trump lawyers took this case is to like, well, okay, we'll just prove Iran's a terrorist threat. And I mean, I guess that is one legal way. I almost thought they should have gone the bigger overview on that issue and try to say well, whether Iran's a terrorist or threat or not doesn't actually matter from a legal standpoint. Right. It's like, what does the law in 1952 say?
Right. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller regarding the Supreme Court's decision to strike down the lower court's decision to block Trump's Middle Eastern ban. You can look for an article, hopefully, on the trumpet here soon. Thanks very much, Andrew, for filling us in on this.
All right. Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour.
The Afghan War is America's longest war. So long, in fact, that parts of the American public probably don't realize that their country is still involved. Syria makes headlines while Afghanistan decays. That's a quote from Kieran Underwood's recent article that's up on thetrumpet.com. But it seems events over the last couple of months are starting to bring Afghanistan back into focus. To talk about this, I have writer Kieran Underwood with us from our office in Britain. How are you doing, Kieran?
Good. Thanks for having me.
So it's really easy to neglect, even as you bring out in this article, or even forget about what's happening in Afghanistan over the past decade. Why is it right now being drawn back into the public eye?
Well, one of the reasons was because the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, had to give an explanation of the defense budget, and they had to talk about Afghanistan because they still have troops there. They still have about 10,000 troops. And the other reason is because there's so much violence in Afghanistan. There were so many bombings during Ramadan. That it just shows that the country is still a mess.
Right. So we had before this budget committee, I guess, 2018, we had Mr. Mattis, defense secretary, giving his testimony. What did he exactly say?
Well, he had to cover a lot of different things. Right about in the middle of this, the hearing's about 3 hours long, but right in the middle of his questioning, Senator John McCain asked him, what is happening in Afghanistan? Are we winning or not? And he blatantly just says, we are not winning in Afghanistan right now. So that's kind of the news peg, the quote that you would see on the Washington Post and the New York Times. We're not winning. He just says it bluntly. And later on, he said the Taliban is surging at the moment.
So this is the same enemy that we've been facing, or the United States has been facing in Afghanistan for over the decade now.
And even before that, 20, 25 years before America even put boots on the ground.
Right. Thanks for correcting me with that. But what we see now is Mr. Trump coming in. Obviously, Mr. Obama wanted to pull all the troops out of Afghanistan if he could. He couldn't do that. Now we've got 10,000 U.S. troops still there. And Mr. Mattis says we're not winning in Afghanistan right now. But then he says we will correct this as soon as possible. What does that mean? I bet a lot of Americans are wondering what does he mean by saying that?
So Senator McCain, he was questioning him, and he was talking about the fact that since Trump has come in, or President Donald Trump has come in, the new administration doesn't have a new Afghanistan policy. You had President Obama's policy, which we didn't see much happening there, but we still don't have a strategy. And that's what Mattis had to try and present to them, that they were going to get a strategy in the next couple of weeks or next couple of months. They did propose, or he wants to propose, sending another 3,000 or 4,000 troops. And the reaction that you get from the pundits, from the analysts, is this is not going to do anything. I mean, it's a great it's a great idea for those people who are suffering in Afghanistan. If you wanted to just bolster a government to support people, to add security, I mean, that would be great. But at the same time, Senator McCain says, we still don't have a strategy. So what's the point of sending a couple thousand more troops if we don't have a new strategy yet? It hasn't worked for the past 17 years. We need something else.
But you do. It is difficult to really sympathize with their decision-making process right now, just because it would be nice if the United States wasn't involved in the Taliban, and especially if so many United States soldiers hadn't already been killed there in battle over the past 17 years. So this administration faces a choice. Do we stay around, and if we're not able to commit a lot of troops there, probably not affect too much change on the ground? Or do we cut our losses and pull out right now? And you seem to think that they're leaning towards an increase in troops.
Well, that's what Mattis would like to do. Whether or not he gets that, he may not. The Congress does not want to pass the budget, which has been increased by about $50 billion. They don't want to accept that increase. So they and a lot of other people would just want Americans all out. I remember one statistic from when they came in 2001 to about 2014, America had already spent around $330 billion on Afghanistan. So they want out with that.
Right. So just looking at the broader situation in Afghanistan, make the case for the United States government that it is important to be there at this moment, because Afghanistan has become, like, it's been probably 5 months we've seen Afghanistan start to make headlines again. And it seems like if the United States isn't there, who's going to control that nation?
Well, certainly not the Afghan government. I'll just read you the introductory paragraph of this article written by a guy who's in and out of Afghanistan. He says, this year's Eid, which is a festival just after Ramadan in Kabul, comes after a tragic Ramadan. Nearly 1,000 Afghan citizens were killed or wounded in 3 separate incidents in 4 days. So You're having bombings from the Taliban. Then you're having a faulty government coming in, shooting protesters. The next sentence says the police shot 6 demonstrators after a truck bomb killed nearly 150 people. I mean, you're having a government which doesn't know how to deal with protesters, doesn't know how to deal with the Taliban. The Afghan army is not strong enough. It has Taliban members coming in and infiltrating it, so people want to desert. They're not sure who's a traitor and who's not. I mean, really, it's pretty tragic in Afghanistan right now.
So with Mr. Mattis, he's obviously somebody that is renowned for just being very aggressive on the battlefield. And we know that Mr. Trump has given a lot of power to his generals, basically given them a lot of free rein to act and use weaponry that they decide that they need to use. This is when the Moab bomb, the mother of all bombs, that was used in Afghanistan. I guess it was back in April right now. So his point is that, you know, we can still affect change there in Afghanistan. I'm just looking at your article right now, and you said that he's got a quote on failure. He said, this is what Secretary Mattis has said in the past, quote, "I don't lose any sleep at night over the potential for failure. I can't even spell the word." So he's not even considering this. And yet, as we've brought out for the past almost 2 decades now, or even longer, going back to the time of Mr. Armstrong, failure in war is what the United States has seen over the past almost half, ever since the Second World War. And I just wonder if you could speak a bit more about that and what we're looking at, how we're looking at this fight in Afghanistan. Is it going to be successful? Does the Bible have anything to say about American power in Afghanistan?
Well, I think the point I was definitely trying to make in that article is that Mattis is is just a remarkable guy. I mean, a powerful, intelligent, probably just one of the greatest generals that America has right now, and a lot of army people will tell you that. But this, having that one man there, that one leader, is not going to change, considering the 17 years in Afghanistan. I mean, you have the other failures, Iraq. We can go through the list, but that just his effort alone, without a strategy, without the will to send, you know, as many troops as it needs. I remember in Iraq, they sent even 100,000 troops at one point, and they still didn't get the job done. We're talking about sending 3,000 or 4,000 more troops. And that's not, even probably Mattis would tell you, that's not going to get the job done in the next year or two. So you have relatively small changes that they're struggling to get pushed through. Meanwhile, as the trumpet says, all the way through, America has a curse that it cannot finish its wars. It can start them. It can go in. It can topple people. It can create chaos. I mean, that Moab bomb was huge. You know, one of the most powerful bombs that America's dropped in many years. But it can't finish the job. And it hasn't in Afghanistan after all these years.
And that's what you highlight in this article here, that just found, this scripture found in Leviticus, talking about how America's strength, or modern day Israel's strength, is going to be spent in vain. And that's what we see in Afghanistan, I think, even more so than all the other, or many of the other conflicts that the U.S. has been in the past few decades. Afghanistan, there's been a lot of money that has been poured into it over the longest period of time. And yet, right now, sad to say, especially for the people that have lost loved ones in that fight, that they aren't going to, the United States is not going to come on top in this war, even though they've spent so much effort to bring that about. God has broken the pride in American power, and they have lost their last war. Thanks very much, Kieran, for bringing to our attention what's going on in Afghanistan. It does highlight, as I said, probably more than any other war, that prophecy being fulfilled. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Nuchtigal, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Kieran Underwood, and to Joel Hilliker for allowing me to take the show, of course. Thanks to our staff, also Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Antonin Scalia. More important than your obligation to follow your conscience, or at least prior to it, is your obligation to form your conscience correctly. Thank you for joining us on the Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.